Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Mujan Sohi. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining the podcast. And Mujan, it's been a little while since we've chatted, but we've got our schedules together. And I kept the response that we got from a previous question. And I think we actually talked about it, or at least we sent email and responses to Maximilian. But he said he agreed with us that you got to design a reliable product first. And then I'm going to summarize a little bit. And he says, and use an analysis to show that we meet the reliability targets. However, in the way he phrased it in the body of his message was, I don't think I could sleep well at night just doing the analysis, just using modeling. I need to do testing. And I thought, I mean, sure. It's great to have a deep understanding of failure mechanisms, and you get good models for it and how things work, and you got previous data and you got a lot of confidence in it, personal confidence that you trust that analysis. And there's still going to be that little prickly thing in the back of your brain going, well, did we cover everything? You know, so you do a lot of analysis, you really understand it, you design it real well, and then check. In a perfect world, that's great. You get all the samples you want, you got plenty of time, all that good stuff. Yet there are times when that's really the only option you get. And there's other times when it's a good to have, it saves a lot of money in some cases. And there's other circumstances, testing's really the only option you get that's meaningful. And other times analysis is the only option you get. And it's, how do you know which one you're in and what options do you have available? It's kind of what I wanted to go back to Maximilian again on. It's going, yeah, just feeling uneasy. I mean, I run tests and go, I don't think that what that really gave us the information we need. Right. So I'm not always, testing's not always perfect. Well, never is perfect in my opinion, but so I don't know. What do you think? Is there a way to sort out when to focus on one or the other or both, or what do you have a preferred approach to this kind of stuff? Or
yeah, I think it's a great question, and one that I hear in my experience. I've heard I've been in the middle of this let's call it a battle I guess, or negotiation of how much analysis is needed versus how much testing. And primarily because testing, of course, is resource intensive and it can add time. And in the world of shorter and shorter product development cycles that, you know, the companies are being pressured into, it becomes very expensive, not necessarily literally in dollar, currency, but also just in the cost of product development timelines, to run more tests. And so the ask usually that I've been on the receiving end of has been from program teams or from executive leadership has been, do you really need to run, like, what else can you do? Like, or can we do this virtually? I think this line of like, can we do this virtually has been, I've been on the receiving end of like, how much confidence do we have in the virtual analysis? And leadership, for what I've seen, would like to see more and more virtual analysis done. So that, you know, we can be able to reduce the amount of testing, physical testing that we do. And of course, then the next question becomes, well, yes, are the models validated? are the virtual models validated? And, you know, how representative are the assumptions and the boundary conditions in the virtual models? And I think it's the same. You know, of course, you could argue the same about testing. So right. It's been, in my experience, I'm curious what you think, but in my experience, it's been like, you know, kind of like a stack up. I'm sure we should come up with a better word for this, but it's kind of like a stack up approach where you think about all right, like what questions can I answer by doing like material tests? And how much confidence does that give me? What questions can I answer by doing like a component level test? And, you know, because component level tests are, of course, they're great because they're faster and they are, you know, typically cheaper than running a full system level test. But you always have to make some assumptions on your boundary conditions and such on your component tests. So it becomes like a stack up of like, okay, I'm going to learn these things about the performance of my product from a material level test, these things from a component test. And maybe if I'm absolutely have to, I will do some, you know, these other things with a system test. And I will build on top of that, you know, some conservative, I don't know, safeguards, I guess, if you will, of, you know, to prevent the problem, to prevent the product from being able to do X, for example, to have thresholds and such in place to prevent it, to basically design myself out of, you know, something going haywire if I don't know, you know, what could happen under certain conditions, for instance. But I feel like there's a better name for it, but but in my experience, it's been usually like stacking things up like that to reduce risk.
Sound like a mechanical engineer at heart.
Do I really?
Tolerance stack up, yeah. But it is. I think it's not tolerance, it's confidence stack up. And it's not the statistical confidences. It's more, do we believe the logic of this? Does it hold water? Does it make sense? Does it, you know? When I get a question, hey, can we do this differently? It's usually a discussion then, not battle. I think it's a negotiation. But remember, I'm not the one that has to make the decision. It's I go back to him and say, it's your program, it's your project, right? What happens if half of them fail in the first week? Oh, I lose my job. Okay, you don't want that to happen. So here's some things we probably should do, you know, design for reliability, blah, blah, blah. And they usually get that really easy. Right? Push comes to shove is when we're down to that last 2-3%. You know, that's harder to find. There's a lot of unknowns. We have lots and lots of clues. The early prototypes are generating all kinds of possible disasters that not all of them are real. Very few of them are real. And it's at some point, it's left to the person that has to make the decision and their advisors, their team. What information do they need? And so, as Maximilian put it, so they can sleep well at night. You know, as a reliability engineer or a consultant, especially as a consultant, I don't get in trouble if it doesn't work. It's not my fault. I didn't design this thing. I didn't build this thing. I didn't approve it. I can advise, you know, here's your options. Yet, what do you really need to know? How comfortable do you want to be? In a FSA, if you want these impossible criteria of proof, you won't ship any products for 10 years. We're going to test every single prototype and production one for 10 years to know if it's going to last 5. And then you'll have a really good idea if it lasts for 5 years. And you know, I can't afford that, right? Well, then you can't have it.
You know? Right. There has to be some level of risk that are taking on. And you know, it to your point, like how comfortable do you want to be? So how much risk are you willing to live with, or, you know, how much unknown are you willing to live with?
That's right. And there's options. And I like the way you phrase it is, well, what can I do on a coupon test? And it's sort of like, if you've got a new finish on a handheld device and you want to know if perfume or makeup or suntan lotion, or as my wife always corrects me, it's not to get tan, it's sunblock. okay, whatever. you know, and cleaning supplies and stuff like that. How will that affect the finish? The coatings were put in on paints or whatever. And it's quick and easy to apply the finishes on the same material you know, apply these different chemicals or agents to it and see what happens. And it's so much easier and quicker. It only takes 24 hours most of the time to say, yeah, it's fine, or no, it just destroyed that finish. Mm-hmm. Whereas I could do a chemical analysis of it, yet different perfumes have different bases and different cleaning supplies. Some use vinegar, some use a small acid base, some other formula. And there's just way too many variables in the chemistry alone that we would involve 20 chemists for a month to solve that problem. And then even then they would say, well, how about we just dab some on there and see what happens?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Not everything like that can be analyzed, virtually or
well,
modeled
it could
or
be.
Something.
It, well, it really, I mean, it really can time. Be, right? It but it's a trade-off. It's some exactly. analysis are very, very complex and time consuming, and just try it. It mm-hmm. takes a day or a week. A lot less expensive, and it's not as if you really want that finish and it doesn't work with, somebody spills a soda on it or a pop. I'm from the Midwest. We call it pop as like a Coca-Cola or a 7-Up or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If that destroys it and you really want that finish, then get the chemist in there to figure out how to change your finish so that it works or do another coating or do something like that. But what Maximilian brought out is that, if you understand a failure mechanism and it's going to last long enough and you design it so it's going to last long enough, when you focus only on the failure mechanism, say a bearing wear out or something like that, you miss the interaction pieces. This bearing's on a shaft that's connected to stuff, right? Where are the loads? Where is, you were talking about boundary conditions. It's those interfaces that often really matter. And so just testing bearings in isolation doesn't make much sense. So you have to have the system around it to replicate the types of stresses and loads and vibrations it's going to see. And so sometimes the modeling alone, the analysis alone, doesn't include the early life failures, the manufacturing errors, somebody dropped the bearing before they assembled it and that now it fails, on and on and on. It doesn't cover everything. And I think that was the but you used earlier. Yeah, you can do analysis, but,
mm-hmm.
there's other things that show up. But I think if you're looking for early life failures or you're looking for interaction type stuff, you start with that, I want to look for that. And that then leads you down a path of, yeah, let's get the prototypes as close to real as we can, or subsystems as close to the real as we can, and do halt. Let's go find the failure mechanisms very deliberately. Whereas if you know what the failure mechanism is and you're wondering, will this paint survive in Tucson, Arizona in the summer without peeling or dulling or stuff like that, that's a failure mechanism. And you can focus just on that and be fine with a coupon and just go do it. But it's, you got to understand what the question is first. And so if that program manager that has to make the decision is, well, I'm really worried about this paint fading, right? Well, there are ways to test that without using the whole system. And we can get you an answer in a month. Whereas if their hang up is, I want less than 1/10 of 1/1,000,000th of a failure per 100 years. And I'm like, okay, that's going to be expensive.
Right. Yes, exactly. Which kind of goes back to what you were saying, I think, when we were talking about this previously, is what are we trying to do? And what are we trying to learn? Mm-hmm. What's the point of the test, simply? Like, right. are we trying to test for a particular mechanism? Do we want to just understand what happens under certain conditions? Do we, and what's our acceptance criteria? I think that's the key question that I feel like sometimes, in fact, I was talking to someone about this yesterday where I was telling them, I showed an example, a hypothetical example of, something has failed during a test.
Mm-hmm.
And, I asked them, what would you like to know? Let's say I come to you with this problem, like, what would you like to know? And, everyone was kind of listing, like they were listing all these different aspects of like, well, like how many units, what are we, what's the, like, what does the test setup look like, blah, blah, blah. And, at the end I was like, okay, all of that makes sense, which are great questions and we should mm-hmm. be working on answering them. But one of the first questions I think that anyone should ask when they come across something like that is, what were we trying to do? What is the point of this test? Does it make sense?
What was the hypothesis? Yeah. What was the hypothesis going into the test?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's something that, and you know, does it matter like that this has failed? Like, is it, what was our acceptance? Let's say the test makes sense. What was the acceptance criteria? And does it make sense that we're, you know, how did we come up to that acceptance criteria? When I was at one of my previous jobs, one of the things that was happening a fair bit when we were going through a long phase of testing was issues would come up, and we would have these reviews with our leadership to talk about the problems that we've seen and mm-hmm. what we're doing about them and such. And one of the leaders had come up with, he was like, you know what, my new favorite phrase is so what?
What's the ramification of this?
Yeah. Does it matter?
You know, and so, is it such a corner case that only one in a million ever going to see this? Or is this half the products are going to fail and explode, kill people, you know, and they're not supposed to?
Right, exactly. And I think that's a very fair question to be asking as a leader in such an organization, which is that, you know, before everyone, you know, runs around to try and spend so many cycles trying to fix the problem, is like, let's figure out, does it matter or not? Is it worth fixing or not?
Right.
And related to that, another one of my favorite things that another one of my colleagues told me from the past was that he was like, in industry, you don't necessarily need to solve the problem. You just need to make the problem go away sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you need to solve it, but sometimes making it go away is just as good, which is very true. Sometimes you just need to make the problem go away. And that, you know, again, kind of goes back to like, what are we trying to do? So what? Which hopefully is answered at the beginning, you know, to everything that you've been saying, I think in the episode that Maximilian also commented on, which is that like, if you design the test thoughtfully, then you should know you should have an idea of the so what, which is the whole purpose of, you know, why.
And it's a so what to who? It's a so what for a particular person.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So as long as there's thought that has gone behind the point of the test, I think, you know, it should answer the question of like, you know, do I need it or not? And, you know, how comfortable am I with this, and what will it tell me? And, you know, can I supplement it with some analysis and then be confident? You know, or do I need to go further out? I think that's,
There's one last point is that if you get a great model and you're working it out, and Maximilian brings up that, you know, it doesn't cover everything, but you really want to, it's a new model. You don't have a lot of supporting separate data for it. And setting up a test with limited samples just to validate, so it should break with this much stress, or it should break with this much, you know, it should show these signs, or the crack should propagate at this rate. It's very deliberately thought through. How do you validate your test? So it's that scientific method. We have an hypothesis. We say that it's going to hold so many foot pounds for so long and at certain temperature, and we go check it. And does it do that, or is it way off? And now we have some doubt about our model. One thing I find people don't do, and a quick aside, is they design a test and they hope it passes because they don't have time to fix anything. And I'm like, well, why are you running the test then?
Yes, I've seen that before.
But the idea is that if what's keeping you up at night is we're not thinking about the earlier failures, we're not thinking about the interaction that this failure mechanism, this subassembly area, has with other systems, or we're not thinking about manufacturing ramp and all the variability that's going to be introduced there. Well, part of our role in reliability is to surface those things. These are all, you know, things that can cause problems, and here's answer that so what question, or help make it visible. Is this worth doing? It may not be the same task that validates the model. It may be a completely different activity that goes after those. And it's part and parcel of the system is testing has to have a purpose, and it has to have an audience that needs that information. And it has to create enough useful information that it's worth doing it. And it goes through a lot of hurdles before you know, throw it in the chamber, as some people would say.
Yes, Exactly. It should go through hurdles so that it's well justified. In fact, one of my previous colleagues in the past she was a design for reliability manager, and she would have for her team, she would have regular meetings where the DFRs would have to come in and justify the test spec that they had written, and not just about why they're how they're performing the test, but why, and why in that, particular manner. And I thought that was a really good practice because it reinforces this asking question of like, what are we trying to learn? And who needs this information, to your point? And, does this test, the way that we've designed it, produce the right information for what we're trying to do?
Yeah, I asked one guy once, he's setting up a test, and it was, how long will it run at this electronics box? How long will it run successfully at like a 60°C, I think it was, or something like that? And I'm like, okay, why are you testing it at that particular temperature and so on? And he had an acceleration model and a bunch of other stuff. And it's, it's kind of a simple accelerated life test. Right? And I won't get into activation energy and all the other things that were just fundamentally wrong with his approach, but he was all happy with that. And okay, it's kind of that, so what? But it's, you mentioned that how long will they run at that temperature, right? I mean, I don't see any cabling in here to power these circuit boards. Oh, I can't afford the time to set up all the wiring. So we're just going to leave them in the chamber cold, unpowered, and we'll take them out every now and then and put them in a test bed and see if they still work. Okay.
So how does that answer the question of how long will it run?
Right. It doesn't answer that. If you want to know about hot storage, that's fine.
Yes, exactly.
And you kind of got, I gotta go get some connectors and wiring and power supplies, and otherwise the test is useless. Exactly.
Yeah.
You need to think it through. What are you trying to achieve?
Yes.
And I've seen vendors do that over and over again. And like, my favorite by far was, I was talking about the other day, is there's a crystal, a little metal can with a piece of crystal sitting on two diving boards essentially inside of it. And it helps with circuit timing and all this other good stuff. And we had one of them break. It's a handheld device that the product hit in our standard drop test things we were doing just as we're getting started. The crystal broke. And I said, do you, how, why should it break? And they said, we do drop testing. Can you? And they sent me a video of it. And there's this guy standing over a piece of plywood about 2 feet above it, dropping a bare crystal just onto the board. And I'm like, well, that's great. The leads are going to bend more than anything else. And the shock will be absorbed by the outer shell of this thing. But when you connect it to its circuit board, the structure of that circuit board puts a whole different levers at action on this crystal when it's soldered down. Yeah. Oh, but we never use solder. We just sell the crystal. We don't sell the circuit board. Right. Okay.
Talking about boundary conditions.
Yeah. And so, I wasn't going to get anywhere with them. So we took it apart and then called them back saying, hey, your manufacturing's not gluing these things on right. You have one little dot of glue versus the whole strip across where it should be. And you've got a real strong, what do they call it? A force, not an inflection point. It's a force magnifier or something like that. So instead of a whole quarter inch of adhesive making this bond, there's one spot. And so all of the holding power was a concentration point, I think it's called. You're the mechanical engineer. What is it when you have a bend or a defect in something and it concentrates the forces there?
Yeah, stress concentration.
Stress concentration.
Yeah. It's funny you say I'm a mechanical, because I'm a materials engineer, but I love that everyone thinks I'm a mechanical engineer.
Well, you make more as a materials engineer, so don't, if we should get that right.
Okay.
But it was a concentration point, and the crack on it, when we were able to replicate it, came right at the edge of where the glue stopped or the adhesive stopped. Okay, come on, guys, you got to fix your manufacturing.
Yeah.
How'd you know that? Well, we cut the top off and looked at it.
Yes, exactly. The looked at it thing is, yeah, that's my favorite, is when, I've been in situations similar before where, I get looped into a problem. And, you know, they're talking about all these possible solutions and, you know, what could be going wrong and all the things that we got to do. And one time I asked a simple question of like, have we looked at the parts? Like that, yeah. You know, the parts that big.
You know, like, if it's well, a dimension here, problem, let's go get a micrometer and go measure them.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the parts are here somewhere. They're in a box. It's like, have we taken them out of the box and looked at them? Can right. we look at the parts first? Like this will like just go. I can understand where the what's the Japanese concept called? Like it's go look. It's a common.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank on the term.
Yeah. Like, or go see, I think is what it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go and see. Mini equal. Apologies if I to anyone listening if I got that wrong. I just googled it. But anyway, this concept of this go and see, I can understand where it's coming from because it is not always done. You know, you if you just like it can just tell you so much if you just like take it apart and or look at it and then you know investigate it and then take things apart. Like you just learn so much about what the problem could be.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, instead of a conference room with the brainstorming going on. Chris always says you can admire the problem all day long, but until we actually learn something,
yes, exactly.
Not getting very far.
Yes.
All right. Well, Maximilian sent us this question, and it ended up, I believe we talked about the earlier problem early at a different episode, but I don't remember right off the top of my head. But it brings up this other one, this dilemma of the modeling versus or an analysis versus testing and when to blend them and stuff. And it I think our primary message is both are great. They work together in different ways. It's not that simple. It's not a cut and dry, always do the both. It's there's cost, there's timing, there's what information are you trying to get? What are you trying to achieve? What are you trying to do is a place to start, then pick the tools to get there. And it's not our confidence or ability to sleep at night. It's the people that have to make the decisions. And so remember, we're not deciding, except for in rare cases where the reliability engineer has veto power. We rarely have that. And there's lots of other factors at play. And so in that supporting role is understand the problem first, what information is needed to help make an improvement, then go figure out what to do. And what are the options and go with that. So hopefully, I'm quite sure Maximilian's figured this out and is working on it, but yet it's always a struggle is there'll always be some uncertainty and some level of risk. Yeah. We got to ship it. At the end of the day, it's got to, well, not hopefully not today when we just started gluing it together, but someday it's got to ship.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And I like what you said about that. There's always some uncertainty. I've been repeating this to some folks. It's like we're never 100% sure in engineering about anything. So yeah, you know, it's fair to say this is what we think is most likely going on, and you know, based on our best engineering judgment, this is what we think is going on. So yeah.
Well, years ago when I was at HP, I got introduced to they called them the Fabulous Five. There's five engineers in the R&D labs that invented the concept of an inkjet printer. And they didn't know it was going to be an inkjet printer when they developed it. It was just spitting out liquid and I had no idea what their original thoughts were. But it ended up being this, you know, billion-dollar industry, kind of billions and billions of dollars of printer industry technology. And so I got a chance to sit down with one of these guys and I said, how did you know it would work? And he says, well, we never really got it to work. We got things that happen and then we refined it. And a lot of other people engineered it into a product, but you know, it fails so many different ways. And he goes, yeah, that's not the way I think of it. I think it's just magic that it works.
yes. I always told my colleagues, like whenever I worked in a factory, I'm like, you know, it's incredible. I think it's a miracle that a working product is coming out of the gate of this factory or any, like in general.
Any factory, any engineering project.
They're so complex and everything from supply chain to all the design and everything that, you know, software, everything that had to go right, or right enough to get this thing together and be able to, like, you know, whether it's like it's a car to drive it or if it's a phone that it works and, you know, whatever it is that comes out of the factory. I think we take it for granted how incredible that is.
Yeah. Instead of a stress ball kind of thing, I have a little piece of Velcro on my desk and I just sit here and play with it and go, why does this work? How is this possible? Kind of thing. So anyway, if you're listening to this, hopefully you admire and enjoy the magic of your products and systems, that they just work most of the time, and that, hey, they fail. And it's kind of job security for a lot of us to go fix that stuff and keep things running and avoid future failures and so on. But if you're running into analysis or testing or some combination of those, hopefully this helped a little bit. But if you've got a question like Maximilian did, let us know. You can head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can find a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Mujan and I and the other hosts are available through LinkedIn and our about pages. And carrier pigeons are hard to find, maybe not that reliable these days, but let us know. We'll try to get you an answer right away. And we'll probably chat about it and learn from each other as we talk about it and get you even a better answer as we go.
Yes, absolutely. And maybe we'll talk about how Velcro works someday.
Yeah, exactly.
It could be a whole episode, many episodes.
Lots of good stuff. All right, yes. Well, thanks so much, Mujan. We'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.